Well, please keep that passage open in front of you. 1 Kings chapter 16 and beginning at verse 8 there on page 357. Our subject this morning is leadership and the struggle for power. That's the focus of the story at this stage of the book of Kings as we rattle through a number of mostly pretty brief and inglorious reigns on the throne of Israel. But leadership and the struggle for power are not just subjects for history. It's been party conference season here over the past few weeks. In fact, somebody in the building this morning, I won't tell you who, you'll have to ask around later if you want to discover them, has been attending one of the political party conferences for their job. But it's been party conference season when the Conservatives and Labour and the others gather to discuss and debate how they might best come to power and then what they would do with power once they got it. The highlight of the party conferences, of course, is the leader's speech. Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer, whoever the leader of the Liberal Democrats is these days, making their case, making their pitch to their parties and to the nation, promoting themselves as the best people to rule. Over in Germany at the moment, they're in the midst of a power struggle, very orderly, dignified sort of power struggle, but a power struggle nevertheless. Angela Merkel, of course, is stepping back as Chancellor, and the question of who will succeed her is, after the election a couple of weeks ago, very much up in the air. There are deals to be struck, coalitions to be forged as the various parties struggle for power. We prayed last week for the upcoming elections in the Philippines, and the list could go on. Leadership and the struggle for power is a truly global phenomenon, a universal issue. A number of you here this morning have come from places where leadership and the struggle for power has been a very painful and difficult one in recent years. Indeed, some of you are here this morning in this country for that very reason. The quality of our leaders, for good or bad, affects us all. And not just on a national political level, our bosses, our head teachers, the leaders in our households, in our communities, in our churches. Leadership and the struggle for power is a big deal. And the book of Kings has some significant lessons to teach us about it as it holds before us here in these chapters leader after leader after leader in Israel. And the lesson that this regal gallery here in chapter 16 teaches us is, I think, well summed up in the words of Psalm 146. Psalm 146 is a late psalm. It's right there towards the end of the book. It's a psalm that looks back from exile. In that sense, it's a psalm written from a similar perspective to the book of Kings, looking back across the history of the nation and her leaders. And Psalm 146 says this: do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save. When their spirit departs, they return to the ground. On that very day, their plans come to nothing. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. Do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save, but in God who is faithful forever. Really, this morning I want to rub into our souls the truth that we must not put our trust in princes, in people who cannot save, who are here today and gone tomorrow, who are powerless to keep the promises they make. I want kings to help us set right expectations, for us to leave this morning with a very realistic view of earthly leadership and what it can and cannot do for us. But I don't want us to leave here this morning hopeless, because whilst Kings lays bare for us people's failing and frailty, where it shows this kind of king to be badly lacking, it leaves us longing for and looking toward Christ, to the one who did not and will not fail, the King of Kings, the faithful and victorious one, the leader to whom we can entrust our lives. As we go from here, you may let Elah and Zimri and Omri fade in your memories so that Jesus Christ might take his place at the forefront of your mind, so that all your trust and hope might be in him. But to get to that destination, we must journey through Israel via these three kings to see Christ's glory set against the grisly alternative. So open up your Bibles there again to page 357 if you've lost your place, and let's take a look together. The reigns of these three only cover about 16 years or so, and the account of them is pitiful and pathetic. The first one we meet is Elah. There in verse 8, in the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Elah, son of Baasha, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah for 2 years. It's a bit of an ominous start, isn't it? He only lasts 2 years. And we very quickly discover why. Zimri, one of his officials, verse 9, who had command of half his chariots, plotted against him. Isn't that so often the way? Because the thing with having a position of power is that other people want it. People by nature, we don't like to be told what to do. We'd much rather do the telling. And the thing is, we all know that we do a better job than the person in place at the moment. So much of people's concern with power is not about what they'll do with it, it's about acquiring it in the first place. And then having done so, protecting it from others circling to snatch it. In this country, we see it all the time with those tiresome Westminster stories about leadership challenges and cabinet reshuffles and Downing Street off-the-record briefings. It's all just part of the ordinary business of politics. The ordinary business of politics is about plotting your way to power. When I was at university, I wrote an essay on factors inhibiting development in the third world. And one factor was the amount that governments spent on security and defence, which at that time had been about 20 years or so ago now, was considerably higher as a portion of the economy in the third world than it was in other parts of the world. And that spending, well, it wasn't primarily fueled by national defence. It wasn't about securing the borders against the threat of invasion, but on entrenching the present or the current rulers in power. It was money spent to guard against the threat of a coup. In a sinful, selfish world, human power goes hand in hand with human plotting. And it was just so 2,800 years ago. Zimri, the charioteer, plotted against his boss, King Elah. We're not told exactly why, but we could potentially surmise that A, Zimri quite fancied the trappings of kingship for himself, and B, Elah was a total waste of space. Pick it up again halfway through verse 9. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the house of Arza, the palace administrator at Tirzah. The army, we discover later in the chapter at verse 15, is off fighting the Philistines at Gibeathon, and we might have expected the king to be there with them, but no, he's off at his mate's house getting trolleyed. Ecclesiastes, reflecting the wisdom of King Solomon, we're told, woe to the land whose king is a child. Well, woe to the land indeed. And again, so often, as with Elah, human power and influence leads to human excess and indulgence. I must confess, I haven't really followed the Pandora Papers stories this week. Maybe you have. It's been a kind of rolling story every day on the BBC and in some of the national newspapers. Another one of these stories where a lot of information has come to light about the financial affairs of the rich and the powerful. And it seems to me, I mean, if maybe you have been following them, in which case you can explain them further to me over a cup of tea later. But I don't know why anyone would be surprised that the rich and the powerful abuse that power to secretively make themselves richer still. Human power and influence leads to human excess and indulgence. Be it offshore accounts, property portfolios, sexual exploitation, as we've seen so vividly and horribly recently with the Me Too movement, parliamentary expense scandals, or getting hammered up at Arza's house when you should be leading the nation. Maybe it was a blessing for Israel that Zimri brought the curtain down on Elah's reign so soon. And Zimri did not stop there. We read in the following verses how he set about systematically wiping out all of Elah's family, just as God had said would happen. As we saw last week, the word of the Lord is the driving force. But in fact, Zimri goes even further. I don't know if you noticed that. There in verse 11, any relative or friend. Zimri is absolutely determined, it seems, to ward off any threat from the royal household and those associated with it. And he succeeds in warding off a threat for a week. But then, verse 16, when the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel, that very day there in the camp. Then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew to Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace and set the palace on fire around him. He had orchestrated a massacre to get himself into the palace, and then once he's in there, it all goes up in smoke. His moment is over in the blink of an eye, with nothing but charred ruins to show for it. And it was no more than he deserved. So he died. Told in verse 19, because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, and following the ways of Jeroboam, and committing the same sin Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. And then what next? Well, now there's no line to follow. There's just a vacuum of power. And so, of course, well, a power struggle ensues. Verses 21 and 22 describe for us a split in public opinion, a four-year-long stretch during which time there is no king. We can see that by comparing verse 15 and verse 23, the dates there. A period of civil war, two factions squaring off against each other. Omri in the red corner, and Tibni, son of Ginath, in the blue. And it is Omri, maybe unsurprisingly, given that he was head of the army, who wins out. And so by verse 23, it is Omri's coronation and Tibni's funeral. Now maybe we read this and we just think, oh golly, what a mess. What an unstable, unsettling, uncivilized time. What a tragic portrayal of greed and violence and self-interest we find here. I am glad that I was not around then. But since the start of 2010, there have been more than 40 coups, or serious attempted coups, around the world. Indeed, there have been 7 so far just this year. Corruption, political violence are constant facts of life in many, many parts of the world, and are increasing. The United Nations reports that more countries are now experiencing violent conflict than at any stage since the Cold War. So far this year, more than 80,000 people have died in such conflicts around the world, most notably in places like Afghanistan, Yemen, Ethiopia. But there are many more. Here in the UK, we are blessedly spared from the worst of these things at present. But that doesn't mean we're immune from the constant turbulence of political and social dissent and division, of scandal and instability, of the backstabbing, the scraping and scratching of people seeking to clamber over one another and drag one another down. And that, of course, is far from restricted to politics. We see it in every area of life. And if we're honest, we see it in our own hearts. It's why we subtly brood over our own position in the pecking order and we silently delight in the downfall of others. This chapter offers an ugly portrayal of human leadership and power struggles and the fallout from them. But the sobering thing is that the ugly portrayal is only a pretty typical one. Maybe even more so when we realise that not all these three thick kings did was bad. See that as we read on into the account of Omri's kingship in verse 23 and the verses that follow. Verse 27 may be particularly significant. As for the other events of Omri's reign, what he did and the things he achieved, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Omri was not without his achievements. He did some mighty, significant things. He builds a new strategic capital, Samaria, which we're told about there in verse 24. Maybe that he wanted a city to rival Jerusalem. It may well have been that in terms of the political situation in his day, that was a pretty shrewd move. He was also a notable military man. If you're interested in the history of these things, you could jump on the Eurostar, head over to Paris and pop into the Louvre and find yourself there, something called the Stela of Mesha of Moab. A stela is a kind of big stone carving with inscriptions on it. And the Stela of Mesha of Moab was a Moabite king, describes on it how Omri humbled Moab many years. In Assyrian writings in later years, well beyond his reign, we find the Assyrians referring to Israel as the house of Omri. He began a dynasty. He was renowned. It seems he was revered. His son Ahab, who we'll meet much more next week and in the weeks to come, he married a Phoenician woman, which indicates that Omri was probably pretty diplomatically able. He was a king who made his mark, humanly speaking. I think historically you'd have to argue more so than any other king of the northern kingdom of Israel. But Kings gives him less than 10 verses. Because regardless of how he may have appeared in men's eyes, He went the same way as every other. And the key concern here is how he fared in the most vital task that he and any of these kings had to undertake: leading the people in right worship. They had no higher duty as the kings of God's people than guiding the people toward God. But in that regard, they are all complete failures. The downfall of Elah, verse 13, tells us, comes about because of all the sins Baasha and his son Elah had committed and had caused Israel to commit. Zimri died because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord and following the ways of Jeroboam and committing the same sin Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. And Omri, humanly more successful, spiritually more bankrupt. Verse 25, but Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and sinned more than all those before him. He followed completely the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, committing the same sin Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit, so that they aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, by their worthless idols. Do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save. When their spirit departs, they return to the ground. On that very day, their plans come to nothing. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. Leadership is not a bad thing in God's grace. He gives us heads in our households, leaders in our workplaces, in our nation, in our churches. And we ought to give thanks for that, and we ought to pray that the Lord would provide us with leaders who will lead in humility and selflessness, leading by example for the good of others. We ought to engage and vote and seek for justice and right and hold our leaders to account in delivering these things. We ought to pray that the Lord will give us the leaders we need and not the leaders we deserve, as the old saying goes. And we should desire leaders we can trust, but we must not put all our trust, which is to say, all our hope. We must not rest the weight of our present fears and our future dreams upon the shoulders of people. People who in the end will not deliver them, because they cannot deliver them. Let Elah, Zimri and Omri teach us to have a refreshing realism about people and power and what they can and cannot do for us. To liberate ourselves from burdening our leaders here and now with an expectation that they will not bear. Over the last couple of hundred years in this country, more and more people have become humanists, whether they'd necessarily ascribe that label to themselves. It is functionally what more and more people believe. It's the worldview that they have adopted. And humanism says that humanity can only advance on the basis of our own efforts. That we must lead the way. That we must put our trust in us. While reading 1 Kings chapter 16 and holding it up against our world today ought to give us cause to reflect on the wisdom of that. If we're to avoid the constant, repeated, crushing disappointment of mankind's abuse of and struggle for power. No matter who or what is said at any party conference, or even at the conference of the parties at COP26 in Glasgow in a few weeks, our future is not best left entrusted purely to us and those who lead us. Kings and princes and presidents and prime ministers and chancellors and all the rest will ultimately fall and fail. And they may be able to improve our standard of living. They may be able to improve our paycheck. They may be able to improve the atmosphere in the staff room and increase the harmony in our household. And the next guy will almost certainly preach a better sermon than the current one. It's not that people can't do anything. Omri achieved, but they cannot do the thing that we really need. They will always lapse into the same old sins, and they cannot save. Only God can do that. And the best leaders, certainly in our homes and churches, will be those who keep pointing away from themselves and toward Him. I don't think we should expect that our politicians, that other leaders in our society will do that. Though again, we might beseech God that they might. But Elah and Zimri and Omri teach us that human leadership and power struggles only end in one place. And that is in the ground. Only one king has ever had a reign which ended anywhere else. Only one king who returned from the ground to be enthroned permanently. Only one king ever demonstrated the wisdom, the selflessness, the love to lead perfectly. And we owe all our trust and allegiance to him. Repeatedly in the reports of these kings, we are reminded that their great sin was that of idolatry. Following the disastrous lead of Jeroboam in putting something else in the place of God, of looking not to him, but to the golden calves at Bethel and Dan, to the Asherah, to the high places. And friends, we must not fall into that same trap. And we must not follow the lead of those that do. We must put our trust in God, in Christ, and in him alone. Because Jesus is the King. He is the leader that we need. And we need to remember that when it seems tempting to put our faith, to lend our allegiance, to give our energy to others. To align ourselves with anyone or anything else is, like it was in Israel, to put ourselves on a slide towards miserable emptiness in the end. For the exiles reading the book of Kings in Babylon, they could see where it led. But we have a king who came and gave himself for his people. A king who will lead his people home to a kingdom not of coups and chaos, but of righteousness and blessing. A king whose reign will not end in a drunken stupor or go down in flames, because it will never end. And a king who will not lead his people astray into idolatry, but will lead the assembly in true, joyous, rapturous worship. The King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the kind of king that they looked forward to and looked for in Psalm 146. Do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save. When their spirit departs, they return to the ground. On that very day, their plans come to nothing. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. And here, as we continue in Psalm 146, is what the reign of that king looks like. He upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets the prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow, but he frustrates the ways of the wicked. The Lord reigns forever. Your God, O Zion, for all generations. Praise the Lord. Let's just take a moment of quiet reflection.